Case number 12-3031, United States of America v. Ngozi Poling, appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Ngozi Poling. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Poling could not effectively defend himself at trial after the district court excluded his testimony about budget surpluses communicated in specific memoranda to all three of Senator Kennedy's chiefs of staff that succeeded Jerry Kavanaugh. The importance of this issue to Mr. Poling's defense is supported not just by the government's closing argument that we discussed in our briefs that Poling kept the chiefs of staff in the dark about budget surpluses, but also by three record citations that are not cited in our briefs. One is Mary Beth Cahill's testimony, and this is at the January 26th AM transcript at 15 to 16, that Poll did provide some surplus numbers in memos, but that they were much smaller numbers, such as 42,000 or 51,000. Because Poll was prevented from testifying about those memos, about the redacted memos, he could not respond to that by demonstrating that he provided much higher surplus numbers straight out of Senate monthly reports to the chiefs of staff, including Mary Beth Cahill. Second, in its opening argument, the government stated that it was Poll's duty to explain how much surplus money was left. And this is in the January 13th transcript at page 125. So that in closing and rebuttal arguments, as noted when the government argued that Poll failed to comply with that duty and kept the chiefs of staff in the dark, Poll had no way to respond to either of those arguments. And third, in closing, in arguing that the Poll kept the chiefs of staff in the dark about the extra money, the government also cited two specific exhibits, Exhibits 8 and Exhibit 9. Those two exhibits are lengthy memos to Ms. Cahill, and both of them contain very strong examples of the redacted material. Exhibit 8 is a 7-page memoranda, 4.5 pages of which have been redacted out. It appears to all be about the budget and about payroll and about money and spending in Kennedy's office. Exhibit 9 is a 4-page memo. Each page contains heavily redacted materials. Now, I understand we did not include these exhibits in our appendix to the court, but if it would be helpful to provide to the court a supplemental appendix with the redacted exhibits that were entered into evidence at trial, we would be happy to do that.
I think the government responds to the basic argument you're making that this doesn't go to the question of authorization to issue the bonuses in question, and so therefore it's not directly relevant to that question. How do you respond to that?
Because there are a number of things that I think this court should look at in assessing whether or not this could have affected the jury's verdict, that Poll did in fact believe that that there was no reasonable doubt that Poll believed that he had authority to do this. First of all, I think that the court should focus on the fact that the spend down, there's record evidence supporting that the spend down, there are three areas I'd like the court to at least address or look at. One is that the spend down process was not the same as the August bonus process. And the second is that in Kennedy's office, the record really supports a conclusion that authority in the office was anything but black and white. And there's a lot of record evidence to suggest, and I will go into these in detail and more in further detail to the extent the court would like to hear that. And third, all four chiefs of staff have reason to be biased in favor of the government, and their testimony should be interpreted in that light. All four of them had a strong interest in minimizing their own involvement in questionable or suspicious or even possibly illegal payroll processes, such as exit bonuses. And so all four of them, for example, backpedaled or would not acknowledge the extent of exit bonus practice in Kennedy's office. But the one person who did was Tracy Spicer. She was the deputy chief of staff. And her testimony made it fairly clear that exit bonuses were routine for senior staff who stayed for a long time. The only people that she said did not, the only example she could give of people who did not get exit bonuses were junior staff who were not there for very long.
Connect up for me the evidence that you think would have come in, or should have come in, and the jury's analysis of the question of authority.
So the the evidence of surplus information went straight, as the government's argument shows, because it addressed it repeatedly, the evidence of surplus information went to what Pohl was communicating to the chiefs of staff. If he did communicate very large surpluses throughout the year in his memoranda to the chief of staff straight out of monthly Senate reports that were based on honest projections, those were accurate, then the chiefs of staff knew or should have known how much money was left at the end of the year. That demonstrates that the August bonus process, in which every year it was $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, with occasional raises to $7,000, could not have been spending down the surplus, or it would have varied much more. Even in Petrosius's first year, when she,
The surpluses were used for other things too, right? Equipment.
For equipment, but equipment was a very low percentage of the budget. I think at one point they may have said 80-20 or something like that. So if they had hundreds of thousands of dollars in surplus money and they wanted to spend it, then they could only do that through salary spending. And Petrosius and Mogilnicki both focused on these $3,000, $4,000, and $5,000 bonuses in August, but they did not even know, or were apparently unaware, that Petrosius's first year there was $164,000 left, even after Ngozi's spend down bonuses. So all of this, if they did not know how much money was actually in the budget left, then that's a very different consideration for the jury than if Ngozi is telling them all along there is a lot of money left in the budget, and telling them all along, somehow we are going to have to, if everybody knows we're trying to get to zero, and there's hundreds of thousands of dollars left that these August bonuses cannot account for, that they don't add up to that.
The excluded testimony you're talking about relates to memos dated after the August bonuses.
No, memos all year round. The memos are more frequent during June.
They include ones after the August bonuses so that they would reflect the effect of them. Is that right?
I'm not sure if there's some in between August and September 30th when the end of that fiscal year occurs. I would have to check the dates on them, and I do have some of those dates. But basically he was giving them bonuses, memos about the budget regularly. It might not have been monthly, but there are memos, they could start in May or June or June or July, certainly.
Okay. Is the relatively small scale of the August bonuses clear in the record?
Yes. I think that everybody talks about the $3,000, $4,000, and $5,000 bonuses. For the $3,000, this is in August, the $3,000 was for people who were very junior, and $5,000 was for people who were very senior.
So we multiply that by how many people?
Well, let's say there are 50 people in the office, and 10 of them get the $5,000 bonus, then that's $50,000. Right. And so you can, multiply the rest by
all of the junior and senior select group.
They say that not everybody got August bonuses, but it appears that virtually everybody got.
Well, then why aren't we multiplying $3,000 or $4,000 times 50?
Well, if you multiply $3,000 or $4,000 times 50 and you get $150,000, $150,000, let's say, to $200,000. But if Pohl's memos are saying there's $400,000 in the surplus, then it's obvious that those are not going to spend down the rest of the surplus money. And the chiefs of staff are not. None of them said that they knew what those end of year numbers were, even after Pohl's spending. So they were not focused on spending down the budget. And Pohl learned from, a situation in which there was a severe deficit under Mary Beth Cahill. And at that point, she told him, and this is from his testimony, to fix it. And he did. And he went through a lot of measures to do so that no one else in the office assisted him with. And at that point, then the next year, there are these very, very high bonuses. He is left with instructions to spend on the bonus, or at least knowledge that the office wants the surplus spent down. And there's no way to, he's buying all the equipment he can possibly buy, the record suggests. So I think, Tracy Spicer's testimony, for example, indicates that that bonuses were happening not just at August and Christmas, but year round. And that is at, That is a January 21st p.m. transcript at 41. And also that the exit bonuses were routine, and that's at the January 21st transcript at 39 to 40. So, you know, I think that it's clear that although the chiefs of staff say that this level of authority for bonuses was very clear, they had it, Paul did not. That is not supported by, certainly by testimony about exit bonuses, which suggests that Paul was issuing them and that no one was signing off on them or checking off on them or even verbally, you know, saying this person should get this much money. And by equipment purchases, where none of the chiefs of staff could identify a number at which Paul was authorized to spend equipment purchases. Paul apparently was responsible for hiring and firing some junior staff. Mogul Nikki said that Paul's responsibilities were akin to running a small business. All of this suggests that Paul's authority was much more extensive. We have a very busy office. In Petrosius's word, there are a thousand things to do all the time. They are pinch hitting for each other. The roles are fungible, and this is demonstrated by Spicer's testimony, by the exit bonus evidence, by the equipment testimony. So the bonuses,
just to make sure I'm clear, the chiefs of staff's impressions or testimony was that they had the authority to approve bonuses, correct?
So any evidence impeaching them at all would have called into question whether or not they might have had a motive.
I agree. I understand what you're saying there.
They did testify. All of them testified. They have the authority.
And the question, I guess, is the larger amount of the surplus money really go to that question? And your point is, well, if it's such a large amount and they're not approving that much in bonuses, they must have known, right?
That's correct. And I think it also goes to, it certainly
goes to,
or there
must have been some kind of implicit authorization.
It goes to Paul's criminal intent as well. Right. And it goes directly, obviously, to concealment, whether he was concealing what he was doing, because it should have been obvious that more was going on. But it also goes, I think, even to his criminal intent at all, that he was taking money that didn't belong to him. And the evidence suggests the government has put in the Kathy Cruz FBI 302 into its appendix. And that 302 says, if you read that, suggests that Kathy Cruz got $65,000 in bonuses over these years. So the bonuses to other employees were also quite large. And, I mean, that evidence could have come in had, in our argument, counsel been fully effective. But I think that, the whole picture here is to look at what authority could Ngozi Pole have reasonably assumed that he had in this office. And all of these facts go to the surplus evidence was really critical to his defense, because he had to show that he was just doing business as usual, and that his spending down decisions to do something with all of this money that Kennedy wanted spent on his people was part of what he thought was his role in the office, or it was, at least that there's reasonable doubt as to whether.
Did trial counsel make this argument about the scale which the data he would testify to would show?
How high the surplus numbers would have been?
The government's answer in its brief here, as Kavanaugh said, is, well, that, you know, that was not the problem, the existence of surpluses. The problem is who had authority to do something about them. And
I think that
your point about the scale, who knows what would affect the problem, but it puts it in a different light, certainly.
Judge Williams, yes, thank you. I think that the important thing to remember is that Paul said, and this is in his, when he started to testify about the redacted memos, I got the numbers straight from the monthly Senate reports. So that,
The point that the numbers are such that the August bonuses could not account for spending down adequately.
So had Paul been able to testify about those numbers, he would have been able to testify about the projections that went, the assumptions that went into the projections that were being made either by the Senate Dispersing Office or by him in coming up with projected surpluses. He would have been able to testify about the source of the numbers if it was in the Senate report or any other. He would have been able to explain how he got to what he put in the redacted sections of the memo. And if, even if he couldn't remember exact numbers of what those surpluses were that were in specific memos, he could have pointed to a memo, and he might have been able to walk the jury backwards from end-of-year numbers or other numbers to sort of put the whole picture together. So his stopping him from explaining what he was telling the chiefs of staff about the entire budget was really cutting him off at the knees in terms of how he could. This was his defense. His defense was, I thought that I had the discretion to do this. And that's what he testified.
Does the record show why on earth these exclusions were made from the memos?
No. We don't have that. Apparently, my understanding, and this is not in the record, is that the Senate may have given these documents to the government early on in this investigation and redacted them before the government got them. And so it was a Senate decision. It was not a government. It was not the prosecutor. It was not the Justice
Senate
Department.
Counsel just acquiesced in
that. Counsel didn't acquiesce. I think that by the time the judge had decided that it was going to instruct the jury not to consider anything that was redacted out of the memos. And then counsel...
No, but in terms of admission of these mutilated documents...
Oh, yes. Counsel did not go try to get from the Senate unredacted documents. Or if counsel did, he did not litigate that, at least, to my knowledge. I mean, that certainly is not in the record, in the district court record or docket.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Sonia Ralston for the United States. I'd like to start where counsel just ended there on the redactions. These redactions were made by the Senate before the documents were produced to the government, and defense counsel at the trial level made no effort to subpoena the unredacted documents, did not litigate the redactions in the district court. There's no objection in the record to the district court's jury instructions, which were given during the opening instruction, that's in the January 13th transcript at page 111, that any redactions are to be disregarded by the jury and you're not to consider or speculate what might be under there. Now, it's a little bit of a bait and switch to acquiesce into that instruction, go through the entire trial up until 10 days later when the defendant's testifying, and all of a sudden try to testify as to what's under the redactions. They had agreed to this stipulation that the jury wasn't to consider what's under there, and I think that should be the end of the matter.
At least we could interpret that as simply saying the jury should not speculate as to what was under or what could have been removed. That's rather different from having someone who has every reason to know what was there from testifying about what was there.
The
I was completely unable to grasp your best evidence argument, indeed any argument you offered in favor of excluding his testimony about the concealed parts of the memos.
Well, let me try to clarify that for you. If he wanted to testify on May 1st, 2005, I remember from my own personal experience there was $70,000 remaining in the budget. That would not violate the original document rule.
That doesn't have to do with notice given to the chief of staff.
That's exactly right. That wouldn't have been relevant. The only reason this is relevant is because he tried to testify. I wrote down on a piece of paper and gave it to the chief of staff, and here's the piece of paper that says that, but oh wait, you can't read that because it's been redacted. It's just like coming into court saying, I have a contract to buy a piece of land, which requires it to be written under the statute of frauds, but I don't have the piece of paper. You're just going to have to take my word for it. That's exactly...
You're sort of completely ignoring the question of who removed the piece of paper.
No, that's true.
I understand Ms. Dyer's point that it wasn't actually the government in the sense of the prosecution that removed the piece of paper, but it was the government and the prosecution that offered the chopped up piece of paper.
But there was no objection.
That's your point, right? That he should have sought the...
Well,
full document.
Yes. So I think if he wanted to testify or have the jury consider what it said on those documents, then he should have sought the unredacted memorandum. Mm-hmm. That's the appropriate way to go about it, because he wants to testify to the content of a writing. The writing needs to be offered, and the writing is the unredacted memo.
To the extent that your argument weakens the direct appeal, it, at least to that extent, strengthens Pohl's ineffective assistance of counsel argument.
So I'd like to turn to that, and the standard in this court for whether a remand is necessary is whether the defendant has presented factual allegations that, if true, would establish a violation of the Sixth Amendment right. And his allegation is that these memorandum, if he had been able to get them, would have shown that he had kept the chiefs of staff apprised of the budget surpluses as time progressed.
And their scale.
And their scale. That would not establish ineffective assistance, because that would have to be, he would have to show that that was prejudicial, that if that information had come in, it would have more likely than not resulted in a different outcome in his trial. Now, given the evidence that was in evidence, particularly Exhibit 11, there's a series of exhibits in Exhibit 11, which are spreadsheets that Pohl prepared listing the bonuses that he and other staff members received over a period of years. Now, this includes periods after he started stealing the money, and he never disclosed on those spreadsheets that he gave himself these inflated bonuses. So the spreadsheet says, you know, Pohl's bonus for the end of year 2003, $5,000, which matches up with the memorandum where the chief of staff approved a bonus for $5,000. He doesn't say, oh, really, I got $15,000 at that time. He never discloses. And those spreadsheets, he produces them over and over and over again to many different chiefs of staff. And I think that conclusively shows that he was hiding the amount of money he was giving himself in the bonuses. Now, that's the issue at trial. The evidence that there were large surpluses is in the record. The Senate budget reports, defense exhibits 20, 21, 33, and so on, are fully unredacted, and they're in the record. They show the amounts of the surpluses. So I don't think that there's a dispute that there were surpluses, that some years they were very large, and it's just irrelevant. Even if that evidence had come in, there's simply no way that the jury would have taken that to counter what was already in the record. You also have Pohl's memorandum, Exhibit 30, where he's explaining to Mogul Nicky in the transition his role in the budget process, and he says, my job is to make bonus recommendations that are approved by the chief of staff. He doesn't say, my job is to spend down the budget if you close your eyes or turn the other way. He acknowledges that my job is to give you recommendations and then to implement your decisions. You have several chiefs of staff talking about how they wait to give the August bonuses, the year-end bonuses, until they are at the end of the fiscal year, because at that point they will have the information about how much is left, how much they can afford to spend. Some years were lean years and they didn't have a lot of money, so they gave smaller bonuses. So they're making those decisions. You know, these memorandum that have their notes on them where they're initialing that they agree to certain bonus amounts for certain people. You know, there's one where the chief of staff met with Senator Kennedy and reduced the amounts by, you know, $500. You know, this is not, they were trying to get rid of hundreds of thousands of dollars and had no way to spend it.
You're still in the ineffective assistance now, right? The
yes.
Prejudice. In my view is that it's a mistake generally for us to consider that argument in the first instance here, because they're inherently fact-bound, and the last few minutes of your discussion has been very fact-bound. Why shouldn't we just give a fresh start on that claim in the district court here?
This court's procedure
we shouldn't be finding facts in the first instance and having a factual hearing on what happened in terms of what the counsel did and how that might have impacted the jury in the first instance, should we?
I don't think you have to make factual findings, but I think this is akin to what other courts do in other circuits where these claims are brought on 2255 review.
We're pretty unique in our procedure here.
I understand that, Your Honor.
If you look at our cases, we do tend to lean towards remanding if there's any doubt at all.
That's true, but the cases also say that the court does not reflexively remand, and the standard is...
We would never do anything reflexively.
The standard is whether there are factual allegations that, if true, would establish a violation. I think this is, as I was going to say, is similar to the standard
colorful.
That...
Right, colorable is in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
A district court would apply in determining whether to have a factual hearing, which
right.
is not always had whenever a defendant raises ineffective assistance in collateral review in other circuits. They apply a similar standard.
So a remand on that basis is not a conclusion that a factual hearing is necessarily necessary. Right. Which your formulation of it suggested it was.
My reading...
Examination is necessary, yes, but not necessarily a hearing.
The cases I have read from this court indicated that when there's a remand for ineffective assistance consideration, the district court has to find facts and decide that in the first instance.
Well, but the district court can find those facts from paper record. Or is your point that if we can do it from the paper record, there's no reason to send it to the district court?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Unless there's a need for additional evidence, there's no difference between this court making that decision and the district court making that decision.
Did you have another question about that?
No.
Okay. I wanted to turn your attention to the defendant's argument about restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And especially his claim that here the offense the jury found, if you look at the jury verdict, it was far narrower than the indictment. And that under those circumstances, the restitution should be limited to what we know the jury actually found.
This court will be the first court to ever make that holding.
Yeah, that still might be right.
I don't think
that
so.
That doesn't deter us, usually.
tell me what's wrong with it. You look at the jury form and compare it to the indictment. The jury form is really pretty narrow. It's just got four... It lists four dates and said on four dates the defendant did X. And it's a lot narrower than the indictment.
It is narrower than the indictment. There are actually six counts in the jury verdict form.
True, the evidence might well have supported a much broader verdict, but this is all the jury found.
So I think looking at the Seventh Circuit's decision in Brothers is perhaps most instructive. In that case, you had a 15-year mail fraud scheme for disability benefits that had gone on. Only three, and every month there had been a mailing. Three of those counts were charged in the indictment. And so the jury necessarily only found that those three individual mailings had happened. But the court ordered restitution for the entire 15-year scheme. The Seventh Circuit said that was
Isn't
correct.
Isn't that just a massive Sixth Amendment problem?
Right, exactly.
It's just on its face, a Sixth Amendment problem.
It would only be a Sixth Amendment problem if Apprendi applies to restitution, which no court has ever held, and it doesn't. It's also not the claim they've raised here. And it would be, I think, because it hasn't been raised, it's been waived.
The government can have an extremely broad indictment, have a jury verdict form on just one instance, and then collect restitution on the whole thing.
Sounds
like a very serious due process problem.
If the charge were something...
You can solve the problem by simply... The government is not powerless to solve this problem. They just need to have the jury verdict form reflect the breadth of the indictment. It's easily solvable.
So I think it's unclear here whose decision it was not to send the indictment to the jury, whether...
I thought it was the district court. Didn't the district court decide not to do that?
What I mean is it's the final conference isn't in the transcript, and so it's unclear whether the defense requested that, whether the court sua sponte made that decision. And without knowing that this might be important because it's never been important before, They had a limited jury form. But the evidence at trial mirrors the indictment.
Yeah, I understand that. It clearly support that. But the jury verdict, all we know from the record is what the jury verdict form tells us.
But this,
for all we know, you know, that's all the jury thought he was guilty of.
But there's
four
only
instances.
I'm sorry. There's only one scheme
in
here.
In fact, the instructions are pretty clear. It says to the jury, it's not necessary that you find all the details regarding the alleged scheme. What must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt is that the defendant willfully devised a scheme to defraud substantially the same as the one alleged in the indictment. So the jury was told it didn't have to go that far. It didn't have to look at all the evidence.
There's only one scheme that's here. And in order to convict on each of the five counts of wire fraud, the jury had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant devised the scheme to defraud. There's no suggestion of some other scheme that he might have devised. There's one scheme.
Well, that's why he's guilty. But the question is the amount of the restitution.
That's right. But in finding him guilty, the jury necessarily found that he devised the scheme. The only scheme that was presented to the jury was the single unified scheme of inflating these bonuses without authorization in order to pocket the money. That's one scheme, just like in Brothers, just like in Lawrence and in all the other cases cited in our brief. And the single scheme nets $77,000. That's the appropriate amount of restitution. And I'd like to reiterate that the Apprendi issue was waived.
Just on that, before you go, why wouldn't restitution be covered, in your view, by those constitutional requirements?
I think the best articulation of that has been the Ninth Circuit's recent decision in Green. And in that case, the court said that restitution is not an Apprendi issue because it's not a criminal penalty. It serves as a shortcut to a...
But they were just saying that the effect of Northern Union, Southern Union was not strong enough to overcome their existing precedent on the subject.
Yes, that's the holding. That's the holding of the case, but there's several pages in that opinion about whether restitution is a criminal penalty at all. And the court, I think very persuasively, says that it's not because it's simply standing in for the civil remedy where the victim could sue the defendant for recovery of the property, for the tort of conversion or theft. And so it's not a criminal penalty like a fine or imprisonment to which the Sixth Amendment applies.
Are you analogizing the restitution order to what judges do under the label of related conduct?
I think that's another way to look at it. If that it's punishment for, you know, looking at how bad... If it is punishment, it's looking at how bad the conduct of conviction is. But I think the more analytically sound view is that it's not punishment. It's simply a procedural stand-in for the...
I'm not talking Apprendi, really. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of whether... I mean, the related conduct doesn't really work, does it? Because the amount flows up numbers, right? And the related conduct, we're assuming the penalty is still below the ceilings, right, provided by the statute.
Well, as the Fourth Circuit has held, that there is no statutory maximum to the restitution statute, and that's another reason.
It disregarded the Supreme Court decision.
I don't think that it disregarded it. It said that it was different. As I said, I think the better reading is that restitution stands in for a civil penalty. The amount, the victim is entitled to this money whether they collect it through a tort judgment or through the restitution judgment, and the restitution actually applies a higher burden of proof because you have to find the guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's actually beneficial to the defendant, beneficial to the victims, because it's more streamlined and doesn't raise the same kind of punishment problems that a fine does.
What kind of procedures does the district judge need to go through when the scheme's broader than the offense of conviction? The procedural protections the judge must comply with in order to order restitution, even as a civil, quote, matter?
So two responses to that. The first is that the district court is required to find the amount for restitution by a preponderance of the evidence. So that's the procedure. The second...
Did the district court do that here?
Yes.
Other than just relying on the pre-sentence report, did he actually make findings?
There was no dispute that about the total amount involved. The only question is whether you count the entire amount. There was also no dispute that there was more than one scheme. The argument is purely technical. There's, I think, no factual dispute here. The second point I would make is that the district court, you know, it's not beyond the offense of conviction. A scheme is an element of this offense of conviction. It's part of these offenses. And just because each wiring or each mailing wasn't charged doesn't mean that the whole scheme isn't encompassed in each count.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did Ms. Starr have any time left? I don't think so. Ms. Starr, you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Judge Tatel. First of all, with respect to restitution, I was going to point out the same thing that you, Judge Tatel, noted, that the closing jury instructions told the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant devised a scheme substantially the same as that stated in the indictment. The only information that the jury had about the indictment was in the opening instructions when the district court said the defendant has been charged with an indictment. It contained 6 counts and read the 6 counts and did not mention anything else. So the jury's verdict could not have been broader. I think with respect to the Apprendi question, I think that this court should avoid any constitutional doubt and apply the doctrine of avoidance by limiting the scope of the scheme to what is found within the jury's verdict. The scope of the scheme should, I'm sorry.
Ms. Ralston would say there is no constitutional doubt because restitution's not a criminal, not part of criminal punishment, therefore there's no Apprendi issue to avoid.
Just in case there were, or just in case that restitution is, in fact, a punishment and that there's a statutory, there should be a jury verdict that supports that, I think that it would be a better course of action to limit, to not make it a matter of sort of a sentencing decision.
Her other argument that has force is that the scheme was charged, and these offenses counts were part of the overall scheme that the jury necessarily must have found.
So I think this court can look at 3 things. It can look at what was the evidence, or what did the government try to show, what was the verdict, and what can the district court find beyond, by preponderance at sentencing in related conduct.
The first element doesn't help you very much, does it?
No, the first one that this court should not decide, because if it's just the government's decision, then what's to limit the scope of restitution? And why does the statute then say the offense, and why did the Supreme Court in Huey say it's the offense of conviction? I mean, it's a statutory limit under our argument, which is what was preserved, and that it is the offense of conviction, and that's stated in 3663A. So to then expand that to related conduct, to say the district court can then find any scheme in sentencing by a preponderance as related conduct is really expanding the statute.
But isn't it, I think the argument was it's the scheme that was necessarily found by the jury as encompassing the particular counts of conviction.
Well, here, if the jury followed its explicit instructions, it could only find a scheme substantially the same as that stated in the indictment, and the only thing it knew about the indictment were 6 counts. So that would limit that had to limit the jury's verdict. On the question of ineffectiveness versus pure prejudice from the exclusion of Mr. Pohl's testimony about the redacted memos, counsel did not necessarily have to get them to get in Mr. Pohl's testimony. Mr. Pohl should have been allowed to testify. He had firsthand knowledge as to what went in, what the source of that information was, and there was no good reason for the district court to stop him from explaining those memos. The government, in its argument itself, said that as the end of the year approaches, each of the chiefs of staff wanted to have the information about what they could spend. They wanted the surplus. They needed that information to decide August bonuses. If they were getting it all along, that was critical to Mr. Poole's defense.
What's your reaction to the discussion we were having with Ms. Ralston about the consequences of a remand? Does that automatically mean the district court has to take new evidence?
I think the district court, I think we would need to explain to the district court our ineffectiveness claim because the district court has not yet seen it on remand, and so it would require
briefing. Could it be done?
Briefing.
Other than briefing, could the district court make this decision based on the existing record?
I think that's a question for the district court. I think that we would want to request this unredacted Senate documents, and so it would become quite an extensive proceeding. And we would want to request also all the Senate information that would support exit bonus authority. So on that note.
So even though you raised the ineffective assistance claim, you don't think we can...
I don't think you can find ineffectiveness on this record, although if the court thinks that it can, then that would certainly support...
No, you know where I'm coming.
Thank you.
Okay.
No other questions.
Thank you both. Case is submitted.